So the idea for today was that we would go out into the real world, and we tried to design a siur chinuchi that would somehow bring to life the integration of halakha and maaseh in the natural world. And since some of you have come from Chutz La'aretz and some of you live here in Eretz Yisrael in a way that's a little more disconnected from the Afar Eretz Yisrael than might be ideal, we thought to revisit a topic which had been explored at some point in the curriculum about mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz, with practical halakha. Rabbi Haber, who's going to be joining us in a minute after I'm done, is going to deal with some of the practicum of Trumot and Maasrot, and during the day, as we move along, we'll be stopping and looking at a whole variety of different sources and things. But I want to talk on the more machshava, on the level of machshava. But I also want to say a word as we move along about the relationship of machshava, of philosophy, of thought, to halakha, this being a program for the study of halakha. And the very best address for this topic is, of course, Rav Kook, who sought to reintegrate halakha v'agada, to use his terminology, which was then so later famously advanced by none other than Bialik, by Chaim Nachman Bialik, Rav Kook's contemporary, although of a very different orientation, let's say. This idea that when you look in the Gemara is roughly 50-50 halakha and what we call agada. Agada being the, well, you know what agada is. As the Supreme Court Justice said, you know it when you see it. But agada is the compilation of thought and folklore and material about a whole variety of disciplines that are not, strictly speaking, halachic, and are the wellspring and the building blocks of Jewish thought. Rabbi Soloveitchik had a very different approach to the whole idea. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought everything was halacha, in the sense that there's halacha with a capital H and halacha with a lowercase h. If you ask me, today's Rosh Chodesh, I forgot Yalav Yavo, what am I supposed to do? So, a graduate of the Halakha Mastery Program should know the answer to this, and will know the din, and will respond with the halakha, or with the din, or with the ruling.
That's with an H.
That's with a lowercase h.
Oh, lowercase.
That's with a lowercase h. Okay. That's the halakha, that's the what you're supposed to do. Halakha with a capital H, in the sense of Rabbi Soloveitchik's halachic man, is a synonym for the entirety of the Jewish system. Because he understood that the wellsprings of Jewish thought resided within the halakha with a lowercase h. And this kind of dialectic between lowercase h and capital H, between the individual laws and the overarching system, so that when people refer to somebody, I remember somebody saying, oh, Rabbi Fink, who knows, like every siman in the Shulchan Aruch, but he knows every sif katan and every, you know, odd reference, and every, he's a real halachic man, because you can ask him, wake him up in the middle of the night and ask him a shaila about, the most obscure, that you can never trump him. He's a halachic man. So he is a halachic man, in the sense that he knows all the halacha, and more important, he performs all the halacha. He's strictly observant. But that's not what halachic man, the title of Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, means. Right? To call somebody that's makpid b'halacha a halachic man is either being casual about how he formulates that term, or is misunderstanding the term. The halachic man is somebody who embodies a worldview that emanates out of the wellspring of the Jewish legal system. The halacha. That's what the Rabbi Soloveitchik said by halacha, the halachic man. Rav Kook talks more in the language of halacha and agada, the more kind of conventional, right, between law and philosophy. Right? But he understood that if you look at the Gemara, when Rami and Ravashi composed the Gemara, they could have done that. They could have created a legal code that would have looked a lot like, like what? Like the Shulchan Aruch or its predecessor, or like the Ran,
the Rif,
the Rif who kind of gave you the Reader's Digest of the bottom line, cutting out in almost every case the Agadah, because he wanted to kind of digest for you the bottom line halakha, and in the process, in the movement from the Gemara to the Shulchan Aruch, and then from the Shulchan Aruch to the works that we're familiar with in the contemporary age, works like the Shemira Shabbos Kilchasa that we discussed yesterday. So the Rif is an important way station, right, in terms of digesting and culling out. When the Rif removes the Agadah from his work, it's not to disparage the Agadah. Right? It was because the agenda of his project was to move towards a work that would be bottom line oriented, because there's also value to that. To say that we need a Mishnah Brura or a Shemira Shabbos Kilchasa or any of the other number of practical halachic guides that you can see in Hebrew or in English in any Jewish bookstore, you know, a big fat book like this on Hagba and Glila Kilchasa. Who would imagine, right? This is the stuff of Purim Spiels, right? The practical Asher Yotzer, right? You know, in three volumes. You know,
With revised editions.
But that's not to disparage the role of Agadah. But the result often was to cause a de-emphasis in the study of Agadah, in the study of Jewish thought. In the Ashkenazi world, this was more pronounced than in the Sephardic world. But today, even in the Sephardic yeshivot, the ascendancy of halakha almost to the eclipse of Agadah, of Jewish thought, is well known. And Rav Kook understood that if you look at the Gemara, these two things are presented hand in glove, completely integrated. And the Gemara flows from one to the other. And Rav Kook thought that part of the national revival, part of returning to ourself and to our land and to our sources, was going to be a reintegration of these materials in a more holistic way. And he sought to advance that in a whole variety of works, including beginning to compose a commentary on the Agadot of Shas, on the Agadot that was selected by the Ein Yaakov. You know, the Ein Yaakov, he was the opposite of the Rif. He did the condensation just of the Agadot with commentary on the Agadah, and Rav Kook wrote a commentary. We only possess his commentaries to Masechet Brachot and Masechet Shabbat. Apparently he didn't continue with the project because life got in the way. But that was part of his study. Aryeh, you want to ask
something? I was going to ask about the Ein Yaakov and how that fit in both time-wise and what purpose.
Oh, the Ein Yaakov is much later. You know, the Ein Yaakov gives you the text of the Gemara, you know, again, a Reader's Digest of the... Not Reader's Digest, meaning the Agadot are brought in their fullness, but they're just the Agadot, with commentaries. And, again, throughout history, there were Rishonim and Achronim that did write commentary on the Agadot, the Maharsha and others. And those are anthologized on the page. And then the Ein Yaakov himself wrote... I'm blanking momentarily on his name.
Ion Yaakov, I think.
Yeah, no, and as he wrote his two commentaries on the page.
And what was his goal in doing
it? Right, so it was to, you know, it may have been, you know, kind of with an eye towards a popular audience, meaning that, you know, this would be something that people that are not regular Gemara learners might focus on. but also to open up the Agadot, which are sometimes, because the overwhelming bulk of commentary on the Talmud was focused on the Halakha, many Mefarshim of the Gemara, both Rishonim and Achronim, Bechlal, skip over the Agadot. It's there in the Gemara, but it's not dealt with in the text itself. Look at the Tosfos, right? On a page of Gemara that is, you know, very heavily, you can have an Agadic passage which is two or three lines. You can have an Agadic passage that runs on for an amud and a half, and more. So on those pages that are densely Agadic, you'll see there's no Tosfos, or almost no Tosfos, because that wasn't their agenda. That's not what they set out to do. Here and there you'll get a comment, but by and large it's just completely missing. The Rashba will comment on the Agadot, but not with the same expansive rigor that he does on the halachic context. The best test case for this in Rav Kook's thought is a work called Shabbat Haaretz. Remember, Rav Kook is born in 1865. He comes on Aliyah in 1904, and he lives until 1935. There was a period in the middle during World War I where he'd gone abroad, and the nature of World War I made it difficult to travel around, so he got stuck in Europe during the war, first in Switzerland and then in London. When he returns, he becomes the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and then very soon after, the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, of Palestine. When he arrives in 1904, it's a few years before Shemitah. Shemitah in 1909, 1910 was a Shemitah year. This was the height of the second Aliyah. You know, we divide up the periods of Jews arriving, principally from Europe, in the early years, into different waves. So the second wave of immigration, which was the decade leading up to the First World War. This was an incredible period of nation growing, even though to a certain degree the second Aliyah is statistically a failure, because a very large number of the people that came did not succeed, and a very large number of them returned. Many returned to Europe, and we know what was going to be awaiting them two decades later. But in terms of cultural advancement, this was a very significant, what we consider the revival, even though Eliezer ben Yehuda arrived in the first Aliyah, the advancement in the revival of Hebrew as a modern language is an achievement of the second Aliyah, along with lots of other cultural advancements. The kibbutz movement is a product of the second Aliyah. And Rav Kook understood that, oh my goodness, Shemitah is coming, we're going to have a serious problem. Now, this was an issue that had been dealt with already a number of Shemitot prior. Already in the Shemitah of 1888, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the undisputed Gadol Haposkim in Europe at the time, he's the one who lent his name to the founding of Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University is Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan.
High school used to be called that.
Well, it was all called then. It was when it started, when YU started in the late 1880s. It didn't start as Yeshiva University. It started as Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, which was actually called after Volozhin. And Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector had died, and they named it in his honor. And then it grew from a high school to a post-high school to a college to a university, etc., etc., over many years. When I got to YU in the late 80s, it was celebrating its centennial. And the Yosef Neiman, one of the Haredi papers, wished them Besonder and Zwanzig. So Yitzchak Elchanan Spector develops this idea of the Heter Mechira. Since it's forbidden for Jews to work the land during the Shemitah, and since the reality of the Meshek, of the economy, by economy we don't mean the money, right? Economic problems today are usually solved by money, right? Water. We always have this problem with water in Israel. Right? It's crazy that we're all drinking this bottled water. Right? It's ridiculous. Right? We have healthy, fresh, clean water comes out of the tap. We all drink the bottled water. We're always nervous about the water, and we're trying, when it rains, nobody's supposed to complain because Baruch Hashem, we need the rain, we need the water, etc. But a lack of rain, which was understood not just in antiquity, but even up through the early modern time, as a very palpable experience of God's displeasure with us. That we can measure how we're doing spiritually by some kind, not a barometer, what's the tool that measures the amount of rainfall, whatever that's called, that is somehow reflective of our standing be'enei Elohim.
Right? We see it in the second paragraph of Shema.
Bidiuk. Right? So these are problems that are easily solved with money, because we can import as much fresh water as we want from Turkey, which is not so far away, but seems to have plenty of water, right? Or from anywhere else. And it's just a question of money. That's it. No, these are technological advances to try. Desalinization alone can't solve the problem. But they can bring in shiploads full of fresh water, right, which they do all the time. It's just a question of finances. So that degree to which we don't, like, we tell our kids, chaval, kol tipa, and you have to close the faucet, and you have to, right? But that's because, like, we've been trained that way. But in reality, we don't sense this connection to the climate as a indicator of our spiritual standing in the way that twice a day in Shema, in Vayom in Shemoa, we are kind of ingrained.
Therefore, when you read the Shema about water, most of it, at least myself, think about money. That it's like the same thing.
Correct.
If I'm bad, it won't rain. Now that really means
the water. But this idea that the connection to the land has been lost. What's the bracha for parnasa, for livelihood in the Amidah? It's about right. The Shana Zot, the Tovet. Let's make sure that the farms work. That the farms are producing. I don't work on a farm. None of us works on a farm. Right? My brother-in-law works in Google. Right? He goes to Google. Whatever barometer they use to measure success, whatever factors out there in the world impact on his job security, has nothing to do with rainfall, has nothing to do with wheat production, has nothing to do with how much grain is in the silo. But yet we think in the metaphor that our bank account is connected to the land, connected to rainfall, because quite literally, as a metaphor, that is the sign of sustenance, right? Because economy and food. Now we live in a world where it's the exact opposite. Once the overwhelming majority of humanity was agrarian, was involved in the production of the food that it kept, that was needed to keep humanity alive. Now, an extremely small percentage, and in Eretz Yisrael, I think it's only like 1.5% of the Jewish population, you can fact check me on that statistic, only 1.5% of the Jewish population of the state of Israel is involved in agriculture. Partially because we've outsourced it to the non-Jews, but even the non-Jewish population is a very, very small percentage, because we don't need it. We don't need the whole world to be involved. We don't need 80% or 60% or whatever it was in pre-modern times to be involved in agriculture to keep everybody alive. Technology and advancements have changed that. But that was not yet the case in 1888 or in 1910. So the idea of the Heter Mechira, that the Jewish lands would be sold, air quotes, to non-Jews, allowing certain workarounds on Shemitah, although it's not a blank check. And if you read the Shabbat Haaretz, or Rav Kook writes this work, the Shabbat Haaretz, which is a halachic work in the classical sense. Shabbat Haaretz goes on for 292 pages. The bulk of it is a halachic work. Both defending the validity of the sale, which was, of course, immediately attacked as a kind of halachic fiction, as a kind of leniency, which would be a slippery slope, as well as explaining the halachot of even under the sale, it doesn't mean during the seventh year you work the land as if it's not Shemitah. There are still limitations, there are still restrictions. One of the things, even today, when many people still rely on the Hetzer Mechira, and this is something every 7 years it becomes a debate about trying to minimize the Hetzer Mechira, because it's easier now, because we don't need the Hetzer Mechira to keep the whole country alive. But in 1910, without the Hetzer Mechira, the jig would have been up. Jewish settlement of the land of Israel would not have succeeded. People would have starved to death, and people would not have come. So even with the Hetzer Mechira, Rav Kook, you know, there are a lot of people, particularly in our national religious camp, who say, Hetzer Mechira, Rav Kook, religious Zionism. And here you see the intersection of religion and politics, because your political view and your attitude towards Jewish settlement and your attitude towards non-Jewish possession of parts of Eretz Yisrael may map onto the halachic position that you subscribe to. You understand how these things are very difficult to put into a centrifuge and separate out. But even in our national religious camp, who often embrace the Hetzer Mechira, not everybody's careful to follow Rav Kook's din. Rav Kook says that the peirot that come from the Hetzer Mechira should nevertheless still be treated with Kedushat Shvi'it. Kedushat Shvi'it means you don't throw it away, you don't waste it, it has, you have to wrap it up, you can't use it for what?
Compost.
That's a different shiloh, whether you can use it for compost.
You can use it for something it's not intended for.
You can't use it for something it's not intended for, you can't use it for commerce in a normal way. It's that all the restrictions of regular food that comes up not from the Hetzer Mechira would still apply to these things. The Hetzer Mechira allows the farmers to continue their involvement in the production of the land, that it circumvents the isurim of working and harvesting the land, but the fruit should still be treated with Kedushat Shvi'it. Not everybody is very... Many people are unaware that Rav Kook held this position, and not everybody is careful about that. So it's important that when we adopt certain positions, which are also in line with our... Well, it's a chicken and the egg. Our political views and our halachic views, you know, as Kierkegaard once famously said, happy am I if my desires and my obligations coincide, right? I'm not being cynical when I say that somebody's halachic views align with their political views, like you shoot the arrow and then you draw the target around it. That's not what I'm saying. It's natural that people's, right? It's cynical to say that evangelical Christians that we talked about abortion in the last 2 days, evangelical Christians that hate abortion, think abortion is murder, so they're in the tank for the Republicans. No, they have a certain worldview that emanates out of a religious position, and they choose a political party that most clearly aligns with that worldview. There's nothing cynical about that. No, so in other words, Rav Kook expanded on the both providing a theoretical justification for the Hetzer Mechira, as well as outlining certain specific halachot which Rav Yitzchak Elchanan had not done in full. And again, remember, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was living in Europe, and Rav Kook was here on the ground. He was the Rav of Yafo at this time, and of the outlying Jewish agricultural settlements. So he was also posed a certain amount of practical questions were posed to him as the thing was put into action.
The first couple of shitot after the Hetzer Mechira was born.
Yeah.
Do we know how?
Yes. Yeah, so it was. Look, there were many of the agricultural settlements were populated by non-religious Jews. And they just worked the land. They didn't care. This created a problem for religious consumers that want. And the religious Zionist settlements, you know, which had only really begun. In other words, in the Shemitah of 1910, it became a more critical issue because there were more farmers that were interested in observing the din and were kind of caught in this conflict. And again, it's not just the practical issue of I'm a farmer, that's my livelihood. What am I going to do? I can't afford to take off for a year, right? It's also a question of how are we going to produce enough food to keep the settlement alive, right?
So what I don't really understand in terms of that position is, you know, the economic exigency of this in 1910 is surely much less than it originally was intended. So I mean, if you think about the Shemitah in, I don't know, the biblical times or whenever the original in practice
right. How Shemitah was practiced in biblical times, well, it's possible that they were not always so careful about that. The Gemara has the idea that there were many Shemitot preceding the destruction that were not properly observed, and therefore the destruction was somehow connected. You know, the Gemara and the Midrash give a variety of answers to the question of why was the temple destroyed, the first temple, the second temple. So one of the positions is that Shemitah was not properly observed.
Right, but that leads to reasoning, right? A priori, how does one today rationalize the need to circumvent Shemitah based on economic?
To
be much more severe.
The meaning, like today, we need the heter less.
Presumably
that is precisely the position of many thinkers and poskim today. And in this last Shemitah, there was this big effort. It was called Shabbat Haaretz, the same as the Shabbat La'aretz. There was this organization that created, they had funds that people paid into and that farmers paid into, basically like a Shabbaton, like professors once every 7 years get a Shabbaton, so that the farmers got a Shabbaton. There were fields all over the country. One of the big fields, when you go down on highway number 1 towards the airport, you know, and you pass those big fields, so they laid fallow the whole year, and there was a big billboard that said, this field is laying fallow for Shemitah and observance of the Shemitah. So many more people are going back to the kind of sense of, yeah, we can manage to do it. We can manage to do it today because of the economy today. And that's why the Heter Mechira has been a little bit under scrutiny. And Rav Kook himself says, I support the Heter Mechira because it's life or death. Could be that this is something that needs to be re-examined each Shemitah or each couple of Shemitah to see if the reality has changed. And many people today feel that is the case. Let's just, we don't have too much time, but the halachic work of the Shabbat Haaretz has a preface. Not such a terribly long preface. In Hebrew, it's about 12 pages or so. Which was recently, in this past Shemitah, it was translated. You have a copy of some of it, not the whole thing, but it was translated in this little volume, which was prepared by my friend Rabbi Julian Sinclair, and Rabbi Bravender and Rabbi Sinclair and I recorded a series of two different series of conversations, podcasts on Rav Kook, most recently related to Shemitah and Rav Kook and Shabbat Haaretz and other related things. And a few years ago, we did something about Rav Kook and art and creativity, and we gave you copies of those discs that have those materials on it. And Julian prepared this bilingual edition of Rav Kook's introduction to the Shabbat Haaretz as a philosophical text. And then he wrote a very lovely introduction. It's actually, I think it's probably the best, if somebody wants to read like a one-chapter introduction in English to the thought and life of Rav Kook, I think the introduction here is probably the best thing, even though it's situated within the specific context of the Shemitah controversy and and Shabbat Haaretz, but for a one chapter intro to the thought and life of Rav Kook, this I think is really the best.
Wait, Rav Kook's introduction or?
No, Julian's introduction to this volume, the introduction to Rav Kook is in English probably really the name of this book is called, in Hebrew it's called Shabbat Haaretz. Rav Kook's Introduction to Shabbat Haaretz. But you have it here on the page. It's right here on page 66. And it was published by this organization called Chazon that does like Jewish environment, environmentalism, and food sustainability and things like that.
What? Julian works now.
Julian, I mean, I think he volunteers with them. I don't think he works there. Julian, and professionally he works in something having to do with... sustainable energy. No. This is a charitable organization. And in the introduction to Shabbat Haaretz, which you have sections from, he's justifying the Heter Mechira, but also giving this rather mystical and poetic praise to Shemitah in potential. The idea that even though we're working around the technical isurim of working the land because of the exigencies at hand, that doesn't mean we're canceling out the whole idea of Shemitah. And Shemitah, the laws of Shemitah have to do with how do you plant, and when do you plant, and the food that comes up, and what do you do with tzvichin, and how is the food brought to market, and all of those technical things of halacha. But the agadah of Shemitah, the machshava, the thought that stands behind Shemitah, no heter, no sale, no workaround, can nor should obviate that. We have an idea of Mechirat Chametz, and the two obviously share some technical parallels. You have to get rid of the Chametz. On the level of thought, we have all sat through enough Drashot and Divrei Torah and read introductory chapters to the umpteen Haggadot that get published every year. Now, what does it mean to spiritually remove the chametz from our heart, or something like that? So, chiret chametz doesn't, whatever chametz is, you know, the it's often compared to ga'ava, to arrogance. Yeah, it's often compared to arrogance. That getting rid of chametz is getting rid of that, remembering that we came from humble origins. Matchilim bignut. Say to me, Mechiras Chametz. You can go away to the hotel for all of Pesach and sell your house and close the door and leave everything as it is, technically speaking. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do the spiritual work of Mechiras Chametz, of Bittul Chametz, you know, on the philosophical grounds. So Rav Kook is saying the same thing here. Het Mechira is a technical workaround to certain Isurim that we cannot observe right now for a variety of reasons. But what Shemitah is meant to accomplish still has to be advanced. What is that? So he outlines an idea of the unity of the land and God and the Jewish people, which was, of course, a very passionate idea, a very pregnant idea in his time when he saw the return of the Jewish people to the land. Right? It was the Jewish people to their land. It was the Jewish people to the home. If we think of God and the Jewish people as, you know, in the metaphor of marriage, of bride and groom, well, this is the home. This is where we live together. And if Galut was not exactly a divorce, but it was a separation between God and the Jewish people, this is a reconciliation in that marriage. And Shemitah is very much connected to that, because just like Shabbat is to the individual, Shemitah is to the nation. He develops this parallel. right? And it's that time to re-energize ourselves, and it's a time to look look inward as a people, and it's a time to reorient ourselves with our values and things like that. And part of it has to do with this, with the socioeconomic component of what Shemitah is about, right? Which is not exactly communism, but it has something to do, there is a certain kind of socialistic, it's anachronistic, of course, to take modern economic theory and read it backward into what the Torah thought. But this idea that it gives everybody, the lowest amongst us, a leg up, that everybody's entitled to certain basic sustenance, the idea that food is food, it's not a commodity, even though we treat it as a commodity, right? In the ancient world, food was a commodity in a way that we don't experience it today. But if you're a little tight in the bank, you understand that food is a commodity. You go to the supermarket, and if Baruch Hashem, it's not you, it might be the person in front of you or behind you online that's, you know, weighing, looking between, you know, should I buy this or should I buy that? You know, should I get, this is healthy, this is a problem, the health crisis, more so in America than here. But what's his name has done so much to talk about this, Pollan, Michael Pollan, in all of his books and reporting, right? Healthy food is more expensive. To eat healthy, it sounds so crazy today, right? But to eat healthy,
well, so much more
supply and demand.
It's partially supply and demand, right? Right. But to eat healthy, to eat out at McDonald's, have you, like this fellow that ate McDonald's three times a day for a year, and then they, you know,
not
saw enough, that his. That his whatever it was that his,
sure.
That his that his that his liver had turned to cat food or something. obesity, of diabetes, of all of
among
these
the
things
poor.
Among the poor, among the poor, right. That it's quite cheap to eat out in McDonald's compared to eating healthy even at home. But that food is food, and everybody's entitled to that. And you leave the field fallow, and the poor come, and the rich come, and anybody that wants can come and take it. We have, do you have at home, you have in your gina?
I don't.
So we have in our gina, in Efrat, we have zeytim, we have olives, and rimonim, and peta, raspberry, blackberries, and so we don't have grapes, but you must have also have in Efrat.
I have grapes, and I have mishmish.
Right? So in Shemitah, so we put up a sign outside the house that we have this week we have raspberries. They're called dichvin. It's not our raspberries, right? You know, don't come in the middle of the night, please. Be polite. But anybody that wants can come and take the raspberries.
Did people? Did people come knocking?
Yes, of course.
They don't knock. They just take.
Just take. Yeah.
But you have to get in. You have to come in through our house to get into our ginas. So they do have to knock.
It was as though that you know, so 1 year they eat, for the next 6 years they're on sabbatical, if you will, from food.
Well, that's a different question. What are you going to eat during the rest of the time? But this idea that, you know, it's meant to reinforce this notion of our mutual responsibilities. This is one of the themes of the work. That idea that Shemitah becomes a symbol of the social, national, spiritual awakening that Rav Kook was witnessing became a central issue. But it also pointed to a difference in how one paskins, and this plays into what we've been discussing with Rav Fink, how one paskins a shaila really does emanate from a certain worldview. In other words, any one individual can look and say, I don't need the Hetzer Mechira. Right? None of us need to rely on the Hetzer Mechira. None of us are farmers. None of us are farmers. And none of us... Hold on a second. None of us are farmers. And none of us, Baruch Hashem, can not afford to buy non-Hetzer Mechira food. But, like, you know, the guy in the lifeboat who says, you know, I'm only drilling the hole under my seat. Rav Kook says, we have to pask in this shaila for the first time. In 2,000 years, we have to start paskening shilas not just for ourselves and not just for our little shtetl, but for a nation. You know who's in this nation? Religious Jews who are not connected to part of the national rebuilding, part of the Yeshuva Yashan, what we today call Haredim, religious Zionist Jews, Chiloni Jews. We need to create a system which is going to enable the collective, the nation, to function according to the Torah. And that's why the Hetzer Mechira is important. Not because I can't manage without it. Any one person can. But the nation can't. And I can't say, so you know what? All of those Yishuvim, all of the Moshavot, all of the farms that are populated by non-religious Jews, that's their problem. They want to do Averot, let them do Averot. No, says Rav Kook. We need a system which is going to be concerned not just about my mitzvot, but about nationally. And that's the idea that, in that regard, this work becomes this kind of cornerstone of religious Zionist, at the intersection of religious Zionist thought and halacha. Right?
It's very interesting. Rabbi Gisser and Ofrat talked about this. We actually all do rely on the Hetzer Mechira, whether or not you want to.
Whether or not you eat food from the Hetzer Mechira.
Exactly, because the money that's used to buy is in the economy.
Right, there's a different problem of the money, what happens
to
the money.
You have to rely on it. Otherwise, you can't use money.
Right. Look, he very nicely provides the text both in Hebrew and English. But the work begins with this leitmotif from the Zohar. This is on page 67 in the source book, page 87 in the book itself. Mi kamcho Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. Who is like your people Israel, a unique nation on earth? When they were united with the land, they were a unique nation. Goy echad ba'aretz. When are we a goy echad? When are we a unique nation? When we are ba'aretz. When we are here in the land, on our land. But not when we are separated from the land. And he understood that that return was a mark of our returning to our to ourselves, what he calls the skula hativit, to our innate, to our natural qualities. So look here on page 93 of the book itself. The individual shakes off mundane routine frequently. Every week, ba Shabbat ba Menucha. Shabbat comes and with it comes Shabbat Menucha, comes rest. The soul begins to shed her harsh chains. And here think of the poor downtrodden Jew of old, who 6 days worked to eke out his living in poverty and in distress. But Shabbat would come, his wife would light the candles, they'd take 2 pale challahs, a little fish, if they were lucky, a little piece of meat, and suddenly he became a prince. So to the nation. The soul begins to shed her harsh chains. The Lord has given you rest from your sorrow and trouble from your hard service that you were made to serve. The soul then seeks higher pathways of spiritual desire that are consonant with the nature of her source. And so too, to skip ahead to the next paragraph on the next page, what Shabbat does for the individual, Shemitah does for the nation as a whole. And then he develops this idea on page 97 that stilling the tumult of social life from time to time in certain predictable ways is meant to move this nation, when it is well ordered, to rise toward an encounter with the heights of its other inner moral and spiritual life. And the note, Rabbi Sinclair points out this idea that, have you encountered in the Shiurim with Rabbi Bravin, did you get to that section in Rav Kook's writings about Tefillah? So perhaps tomorrow he'll get it. I don't want to jump the gun. But Rav Kook, in the beginning of his introduction to his commentary on the Sidur, has this idea of the Tefillah HaMatmedet Shel HaNishama. What does it mean that we daven 3 times a day? How is it that we only daven 3 times a day? Why not daven 4 times a day? Why not daven five times? Why not just only daven? Right? So if Cook says in a chinami, we're always davening. The comparison that I once made was, it's like, I remember when I was a kid, the old stoves used to have a pilot light, right? In other words, in the stove there was always a little flame. And when you wanted to boil a pot, you would turn on the burner, and that flame, the gas would come up, and it would be lighted from that flame. There was always that danger that the flame would go out, and everybody would be asphyxiated from the gas. But when you turn off the flame on the burner, inside there's this little pilot light that's going. So Rav Kook says that's what davening is. We're always, the neshama is always in conversation with God, but sometimes it's latent. It's the pilot light that's in the soul. And three times a day, you put your feet together, you face your shalayim, you take a sitter, and the fire comes up to the surface.
Like
a ner tamid, maybe. But the ner tamid is always visible. It's always constant. Here, it's up and down. It's similar to an idea, to go back to where we began, the comparison between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Kook. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a similar idea, but in a very different direction. So we're always learning. And it shows the different emphases. How is it that we learn Torah now? Everybody came this week, we're learning Torah this week. But what are you going to do next week? You're going to learn as much Torah next week as you did this week? I hope so, but maybe not, because people have to go to work. So how is it we say every time I'm going to have later I'm going to have another cup of water, I'll say another bracha. Tonight I'll have another cup of water, I'll say another bracha. But for learning, we all said Birkat HaTorah in the morning, and that's enough for the whole day. So you say Birkat HaTorah in the morning, and then you go off to work. And then during lunch, you take out the Daf Yomi. Why don't you say another Birkat HaTorah? So the Rav says that it's the same idea. That the neshama is always learning. He didn't say neshama, right? But that the mind, the Jewish mind, is always engaged. Sometimes it's active and sometimes it's latent, right? But that idea that we are, you know, somewhere in the subconscious, also a word he didn't use, you know, we're always engaged with learning. So these are very interesting parallel ideas, and it shows something of their different areas of focus and orientation. So this is the Shabbat. It's worthy of the whole thing is worthy of your attention. Precisely because it's this interesting test case of the intersection of halacha and machshava, or halacha and agadah in Rav Kook's terminology, which I think underscores a lot of what we've been talking about this week and what we've been talking about for the past 3 years in terms of psak, in terms of halacha, in terms of the orientation that the learner of Torah needs to have, and it hopefully will orient us for what we'll be doing.